Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The problem that everybody runs up against, of course, is that Congress is paid for by the military-industrial complex.
We're joined by peace activist and organizer with October 2011, David Swanson. He's author of When the World Outlawed War, War is a Lie, and Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. David Swanson, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hey, Dori, great to be here.
And soon you'll be welcoming other people to the show as you begin guest hosting Talk Nation Radio. I'm very, very happy about this development and excited to have you come on board and take over the show.
Well, you and I both, I'm very much looking forward to it. I hope I'm up to the task.
Oh, I'm sure you're more than up to the task. And I actually am looking forward to reading your new book. Why don't you tell us about first the new book that's just released?
Well, the very latest, just published on Martin Luther King Day, is The Military-Industrial Complex at 50, or MIC50. And you can go to MIC50.org and buy it or find out about it. And it's not by me. It's by me and over a dozen other authors, experts on various aspects of the military-industrial complex, which actually turned 51 yesterday as we're recording this, dating not from, of course, the very initial stages of the military-industrial complex, but dating from the speech in which President Eisenhower named it and warned against it and warned us that it would influence our lives, even our spiritual lives. It would influence every city, every state house, every Congress member's office. And of course, he was very much right. He just was not extreme enough. The military-industrial complex has been growing dramatically since Eisenhower was president, and it eats up over half of federal discretionary spending. A small town like the one I live in, we've calculated the taxpayers put in over $100 million every year just into military spending. We could cut it by 80% and still have the largest, most expensive military in the world. It's incredibly disastrous in so many different ways that we had experts who work on the environment, experts on civil liberties, experts on representative government, on health. You know, no matter what your good cause is, the money that could be bringing us up to world quality standards is going instead to create bombers and missiles and bombs and billionaires. It is the number one way we destroy the natural environment. It's the number one way we transfer wealth to the super wealthy. It is what makes us different from Northern Europe, from other countries that are not as wealthy as we are, but have higher standards of living, longer life expectancies, lower infant mortality, better education, better vacations and security and happiness. So it's a problem that we want to bring a big coalition together on to confront in the way that it deserves.
And really the $64,000 question is, what can government do to rein in the military-industrial complex as we look at, you know, Rumsfeld's long war continuing, you know, and really things not stabilizing the way we'd like to see them stabilize in the Middle East, the U.S. starting to take a look now at different parts of the world, you know, too, and expanding its interests. And that's always the question, isn't it? Do, you know, financial or security interests lead the way when it comes to any part of the world that is under study at any given time by, let's say, foreign policy, you know, analysts who work with these military industries and make these long-term plans, right?
Well, of course, Eisenhower in an earlier draft had said military-industrial congressional complex and was persuaded to take that out. But of course, it was right. And the power that the military contractors, the weapons profiteers have over the Congress members is incredible and comes not only through our public spending on weaponry, but also through the incredible business of providing the weapons to the rest of the world. It is among our top five exports. We are far and away the leading producer and supplier of weapons to the world. We supply both sides in many conflicts. We arm over 100 nations, and that means jobs. And there are jobs through our public spending on the military and through the weapons industry that arms the world in every single congressional district. We have single pieces of armaments intentionally manufactured in little bits across dozens of congressional districts purely in order to influence those Congress members. And the fact is that any other form of public spending creates more jobs. So it's an absolutely bogus argument to say that we need the military as a jobs program, not to mention being an absurdly immoral argument that we're going to arm a force that creates momentum for war and bloodshed in order to create jobs. But it's wrong, purely economically. You put the money into education or energy or any kind of research or infrastructure, or even into tax cuts for working people, and you get more jobs. So there is something that we could do. There is something that for decades was introduced into Congress and never passed. There was a bill that our current Secretary of so-called Defense, Leon Panetta, a couple of decades back supported. You could begin the process of converting industries from military to nonviolent industries. You could retrain, you could retool, you could provide jobs to everybody who loses a job and more. You could hire people who don't have a job. And, you know, at the local level, we still have influence. Our local city council here in Charlottesville, Virginia, passed the first resolution in the country saying to the president and the Congress, not just cut back the military spending and put it into human needs, but do not attack Iran. And that resolution came out of the same conference that produced this book that we had just published, the MIC50.org. And we need more towns and more cities and state legislatures to take that step. We are a long way from being able to impose the public will on Congress, but this is how it starts. It starts through mass education and organizing and spreading the word and working our way up the levels of representation. So beginning to get towns and cities on board is going to be very helpful.
And of course, I'm looking at that resolution right now and the first lines of it, you know, calling on Congress and the president to redirect military spending to domestic priorities. And I just want to start by asking you about the fact that the U.S. Conference of Mayors is involved in this as well. And they've also passed a resolution in 2011 calling on Congress to do the same and to start looking at education, at alternative energy, at healthcare as ways to build up our economy rather than always relying on this really deeply troubled and even corrupt military industry.
Well, there are other cities that have passed good resolutions, and the U.S. Conference of Mayors at its convention last summer passed a resolution that did not mention the war in Iran. It was not quite as strong as the resolution that Charlottesville has just passed, but it addressed itself to Congress, and it asked that military spending and war spending be cut and the money be put into useful programs. And this was something that our then mayor and now city council member in Charlottesville, Dave Norris, was an early supporter of, and we were very proud of that. And peace organizations like Code Pink did a great deal of work to get that passed by the mayors. And it's part of what has influenced the debate in Washington, where talk of cutting the military is on the table and on the television screen for the first time in a lot of years now. Sadly, it amounts primarily to just talk. A lot of it is talk of cuts that are cuts to dream budgets for future years so that the actual budget for future years after the cuts actually amounts to an increase over this year's budget. Nice little trick that they're fond of playing on us. But there is serious talk of more significant cuts. There are even cuts that have now been mandated by the deal that Congress put through given the super committee's failure to come up with any solution. Whether those cuts hit the military or they're all imposed on veterans and the State Department, and whether we can get much more significant cuts than those, as decency and the economy and the environment and everything else requires, remains to be seen. But I think the problem that everybody runs up against, of course, is that Congress is paid for by the military-industrial complex. We're asking them to turn against themselves, which is why I am also a big supporter of this movement to strip corporations of rights, to end corporate personhood, to end corporate free speech rights, under which spending money is considered protected speech under our Constitution. And there are two ways to amend the Constitution. Either we get two-thirds of Congress and then three-quarters of the states, or we just get two-thirds of the states and then three-quarters of the states, and we completely circumvent Congress. This is what Article 5 of the Constitution says we can do. And there are going to be rallies on Friday all over the country. People should go to movetoamend.org and find out about it. One way or another, we have to strip the corporate persons, and the biggest, baddest ones are the weapons makers. We have to strip them of their supposedly human rights.
When the U.S. was looking at entering into an occupation, really, of Iraq, there were a lot of people, you among them, who warned against this and expressed deep concern that the American people might even, you know, be thinking against their own interests of supporting this kind of war. And so talk about where we've come from now and what that all means. I know we're facing extreme economic crisis, but it seems to me that no one's putting the picture together. So I was really delighted to see your book. Just talk about the way the book brings that information together in a way we can understand and put the pieces together for ourselves. But also talk about the fact that for so many of us, we're just not getting the kind of information we need ahead of decisions that might be made about a pending war.
One of my earlier books was called War is a Lie, and I'm very pleased to see it selling pretty well now during this build-up to the potentially the next big war. We hope it doesn't happen, that we succeed in stopping it, as we've succeeded for years now, and we don't get the credit. They never hold the ceremony to announce that we've prevented the war for another week or another year. But it's hard for people to get back into thinking not just about how dramatic and certain the lies were, that Iraq had nuclear weapons, that Iraq had chemical and biological weapons in vast stockpiles, that this was absolutely certain, that we knew where the vast stockpiles were, and so forth. Some people do remember that, but almost nobody remembers how pleasant and joyful it was going to be. It was going to be a very short and quick war. It was going to more than pay for itself. We were going to make a profit off it. The Iraqi oil was going to pay for its liberation. The people were going to welcome their occupiers with chocolates and flowers. I mean, nobody recalls how pleasant it was going to be, because it dragged on for years and years, is not over yet, essentially destroyed a nation, killed over a million people, drove millions of people into refugee status and shortened their lives, killed thousands of U.S. soldiers in the process, and tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers' lives ruined in one way or another. And here we are hearing very, very similar lies about Iran. And there's talk of maybe Israel will do it. Maybe it will be a couple of surgical strikes. Maybe it will just be some more assassinations, as we call these murders of Iranian scientists. Or maybe we'll have no choice. We can't do nothing, so we'll have to have a war, as if those are the two options. And Iran is not allowing inspections, just as Iraq was not allowing inspections. Absolutely false in both cases. The inspections that are not happening are finding a nuclear weapons program. Absolutely false in both cases. You know, Iran tried to blow up a Saudi ambassador in D.C. Absolutely false. Iran is behind 9/11. They trot out the exact same charge. Now it's Iran that was behind 9/11. It's incredible, the insulting effrontery, that the way that they imagine we will fall for the exact same lies. And to our great credit, we aren't, but we're starting to slip. You look at the polls, you look at the public discussion, the American people are starting to slip. And this is why I wrote that book, War is a Lie. I wanted people to know that these were lies before a war began. I wanted people to understand that even if all of these claims were true, they don't begin to morally or legally justify a war, and that they are false, and that we can know that they are false, and that the information is always readily obtainable. We don't have to wait until the war starts. And so people can go to don'tattackiran.org and find more than enough information to satisfy themselves and their friends and their neighbors that we are being fed a diet of lies once again.
Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1961, his farewell speech to the White House.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
We asked David Swanson to talk more about the way the U.S. media and the government have both overlooked Saudi Arabia while discussing America's military response to 9/11.
Almost all of the hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi. Funding and resources behind that terrorist effort were Saudi. It's not that we attacked the wrong country. There's no justification for attacking any country. I don't wish we had bombed Saudi Arabia. But there's this incredible hypocrisy in that you take one nation that is friendly with the U.S. government and providing oil to the United States and to U.S. corporations, and they have immunity. They have immunity almost from criticism of human rights violations. We have human rights violations trotted out as a justification for war. I mean, it is almost routine now to hear about the need to bomb women to protect them from being stoned, as if, you know, the bombing is more pleasant than the stoning. In countries that do not routinely stone women and whose governments do not permit the stoning of women. But you look at Saudi Arabia and its brutality, its restrictions on civil liberties. There is some slow progress in the right direction in some areas of civil liberties and human rights. But there is just no comparison between how nations like Saudi Arabia and Israel that are on good terms with the U.S. military are treated and how we use violations of human rights and limitations in good government in other countries as a justification to bomb or invade them. And so you have an incredible contrast. I was told by a friend who watched 60 Minutes last week about a glowing story about essentially the dictator of Qatar and, you know, how well off the people were and what a great country it was. And of course, this is a country that sends troops to join in our escapades, that allows U.S. military planes to land, that supports the U.S. military, you know, praised as a great progressive beacon of democracy because of its benevolent dictator. And you could have done similar stories about Gaddafi, but that was not in the interest of the Pentagon. You know, Gaddafi was a target. And so we have to sort of come to grips with the fact that our humanitarian wars are not humanitarian wars. These are just some of the excuses for wars that have completely different motivations, that have motivations to do with resources, with oil, with basing of troops and weapons, with the expansion of political influence and power, or at least the futile attempt at such. We have to sort of confront the fact that 9/11 is being randomly used as the basis for attacking countries that had absolutely nothing to do with it, Iraq and Iran.
David Swanson, I wanted to ask you where to begin with a challenge now to the military-industrial complex and the way that it gets a pass, let's say, on regulation or even examination. But should it be more of a legislative process, a local challenge that way? Or what about, for example, what people in Nigeria just accomplished? You know, they went on a general strike. They said, we can't afford to pay double gas prices, so we're going off work. And it apparently, for now anyway, has worked in their interests.
Well, I think we need to move in that direction. There are plans for general strikes this spring. If people go to warisacrime.org and click on events, there are a lot of events nationally and in D.C. and in key locations this coming spring. I mean, this is going to be decisive for us. If this Occupy movement can come back bigger and better as the weather warms up, if rather than taking several months off to do the lesser evilism of sitting on our hands and obsessing over whether we're going to vote for this warmonger or that warmonger come the 1st of November, if instead of that we stay independent and principled, we honor Dr. Martin Luther King, whose holiday we've just celebrated, who never endorsed a candidate or a party or put his hopes in an election, if we continue to build a principled, independent, nonviolent pressure movement that moves the entire culture, that shifts the debate, changes the conversation, disrupts the comfort and convenience of those who are doing us wrong at every level within government and those puppet masters who are telling the government what to do, who are not all on Wall Street. Many of them are in the neighborhood of the Pentagon in Northern Virginia. They are the bankers. They are the war profiteers. They are the billionaires. If we can push the entire country against them, this is the lesson I drew from my recent book on When the World Outlawed War, which looked at the 1920s and the successful passage of the Kellogg-Briand Pact that made wars illegal, which they still are. They eventually got every presidential candidate of every party. There were at least four relevant parties. They moved the entire culture, and they never put their eggs in the basket of a politician. This is how it has to be done. And I think a key strategy at this point, again, is to move the entire country toward fixing our Constitution. And I suspect it will have to be done without Congress. You know, moving good bills, and there are already many good bills in Congress on this, is helpful. But I strongly suspect we will have to go around Congress, or at least have a credible threat of doing so, to get Congress to move. But I think the movement against the military-industrial complex and the movement against corporate personhood and corporate rights need to merge and understand themselves as one and the same, and that the Occupy movement needs to be joined with those two as well.
And what kinds of things are coming up now for the Occupy movement, for the protest movement overall? Because I know that a lot is planned, a lot's been going on, and fallen a little bit under the radar of the corporate media. Not that that's always such a bad thing, right?
Sometimes that's good. Sometimes there is coverage that's worse than no coverage. But I think, again, on January 20th, which is the day before the two-year mark of this Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which really expanded the unlimited rights of corporations to buy our elections, there are going to be events all over the country called Occupy the Courts. There are going to be rallies in front of federal courthouses in over 100 cities. And you can go to warisacrime.org and click on events, and you'll get there. And January 23rd, not long after, is the first day in which many groups will be attempting something like a general strike. And there are lots of events in the following months leading up to what we hope will be an enormous effort to nonviolently occupy Washington, D.C., beginning on March 30th. So there are national peace conferences happening, including right up there in Stamford, Connecticut, March 23rd to 25th, just a week before. We hope there will be this huge occupation of D.C. starting on March 30th. This is going to be really critical to see if we can come back bigger and stronger and more strategic, and yes, with demands. We must reject this "we don't have any demands" nonsense and state quite clearly that our demand is for self-governance, for an end to plutocracy and this pretense of a democracy while we're governed by this incredibly wealthy elite.
We'll talk about the plutocracy angle here, too, because I think a lot of people don't quite realize how much power and authority these military industries really hold. And let's just mention a few of them. I know Raytheon's here in Connecticut. We see United Technologies, Pratt & Whitney. Over these many years, people relying on these companies and the Groton Shipyard for Electric Boat, where they build nuclear submarines, as job insurance, kind of, you know. But those jobs are leaving the state. And the question remains, how many nuclear submarines does the country need to build?
My answer would be none, of course. They don't serve a defensive purpose. We call it the Department of Defense, but the vast majority of the weapons serve no defensive purpose, and many of them serve no offensive purpose either. Many of them are just relics of past decades' wars that continue to get built because somebody makes a buck from it. And yes, military jobs close and leave and get moved, but others are created. The military is not shrinking. The military spending is not shrinking. The military budget has essentially doubled in the past 10 years, and yes, has continued to grow each of the past 3 years with the new president in the White House. And it is ever more profitable, ever less accountable, and ever more free to redirect a small pinch of that money back into the election campaigns of Congress members and presidents, further entrenching that power. I know that President Obama is expected to accept the Democratic Party's nomination in the Bank of America Stadium down in North Carolina. I think the U.S. Capitol at this point ought to have Lockheed Martin's name or some similar name on it, given the influence and the control that these corporations have over what is supposed to be and still pretends to be our government. Lockheed Martin doesn't just run the computer system and the emails that you send your Congress member. It runs your Congress member. With very few exceptions, these military contractors control our government, both through what are called contributions and what are called free speech expenditures on electoral advertisements, but also through this pretense that it's a jobs program. It goes against everything that right-wingers stand for in this country. It is massive government spending to generate jobs, and they defend it purely as such. But it's spending on jobs to work for the end of killing human beings, to make stuff with no other purpose than to kill people or to threaten to kill people. And we could spend the same dollars. In fact, we could spend a lot fewer dollars and generate more jobs. So it's actually a drain on our economy, purporting to be the one silver lining, the one place where the economy is doing okay. Ironically enough, through the government spending that our market evangelicals claim is bad for the economy. It's not. We need the government to invest in the economy, and we need it not simply to stop doing so through weaponry, but to shift to doing so through green energy and education and mass transit and so forth. And in the process, we could have some tax cuts. And if we were to make the billionaires and the corporations pay taxes, we could have some real tax cuts for the rest of us.
David Swanson, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Dory.
You can learn more at MIC50.org, as well as warisacrime.org. David Swanson is author of When the World Outlawed War, War is a Lie, and Daybreak. His latest work, The Military-Industrial Complex at 50, is jointly authored with Ellen Brown, Paul Schappel, Helena Coban, Ben Davis, Jeff Vogel, Bunny Greenhouse, Bruce Gagnon, Claire Hanrahan, John Hauer, Steve Horn, Robert Jensen, Karen Kwiatkowski, Judith LeBlanc, Bruce Levine, Ray McGovern, Wally Myers, Robert Nyman, Gareth Porter, Chris Rhoda, Alan Ruff, Mia Austin Scoggins, Tony Russell, Lisa Savage, Mary Beth Sullivan, Coleman Smith, Dave Shreve, Pat Elder, Jonathan Williams, and Ann Wright. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org is our website, and we look forward to having David Swanson hosting the show coming up soon. Our music is by Fritz Heed.